That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, hello everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. As usual, I am That Money Guy, aka Gabriel, but I go by That Money Guy over the next hour or so. And during that period, we're going to be discussing so many things, but overall, the objective from me to you is to get you better with your money. And how do we do that on this show? Well, we do a few things. At first, we like to discuss some things going on in the news, but not just general news, the actual news that is relevant to your back pocket, the things that will actually affect your day-to-day life. And then after that, we bring in some incredible guests. And this week, we're going to be bringing Stephen O'Brien, the founder of Steve Teaches Crypto, ready? And Claire Seal, a content creator and author. But as promised, we start with the news, and joining me in the studio is Kalpana Fitzpatrick, the digital editor of Money Week. How are you doing? And welcome to the studio.
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
Very lovely to have you here today. Now, we're going to discuss a bunch of topics, including the classic ones like interest rate and inflation. We've got some announcements, like we were discussing before, coming up this week. But I think the most interesting story of the lot is about property. In particular, first-time buyers, of which I guess will be one because I don't own a property, so I have to become a first-time buyer eventually. And this story in particular is about, you know, the amount that first-time buyers are needing from loved ones, family members to actually get onto the housing market, and also the age at which it's starting to happen. So the study that came out was that we are doubling the amount of people that need contribution from families since 2009. So we've gone up from 10% to 20%, as well as the average first-time buyer age going from the age of 32 in 2004 to 36 in 2022. I'm 26, so that probably gives me a nice 10-year horizon. I can take it nice and chill. But I suppose overall, those aren't good statistics. We want things to be shifting the other way. We want more young people to be able to have that optionality. So, as a journalist, obviously one that studies this field, how do you feel about this news?
It doesn't surprise me. Now, we do have a culture in the UK where it's you must buy a property, but I feel that puts a lot of pressure on a lot of people, and sometimes that's all they want to do. So I'm actually it's good that people aren't putting off major life sort of milestones like having a children, getting married, or, you know, having that big holiday, doing what they want to do. Now, there was a time where renting might have been a little bit cheaper, but actually there was another study out, I think it was last week, from Zoopla, saying actually buying is 8% cheaper than renting. So I can see why people do want to get onto the property ladder, but we've got high mortgage rates at the moment, with interest rates being quite high. Property prices, they've been fluctuating, but they're still quite high when you look at them historically. Mm-hmm. So trying to put that deposit together is a lot tougher. So I think where people have just got to this stage now where they feel, actually, you know what, I'm not going to put off having a family. I'm not going to, you know, put off whatever I want to do. That property will happen. But I think what I would like to actually see, however, is people moving away from that pressure as well. I think there's just so much pressure. And what I am seeing, however, is people are moving out of London, let's say, because this is where a lot of the problems. London is a fascinating place. It's a brilliant place to live in. Of course it is. And we all want to be in the centre of attention. But it is also one of the most expensive areas, and property prices are almost out of reach for first-time buyers in London. So we are getting people moving out of London and looking outside of, Scotland, for example, might be a place where people might be looking. And I speak to people all the time, and actually they are rethinking about the type of property they buy and where they locate. Young people also, they are moving back with their parents. Now we cannot get rid of the kids. And I think that's great if the parents are happy to have their adult children living at home, because actually it does give that opportunity to save up for that deposit and get onto the property ladder. But I think what really gets people at the moment is that it's a cultural thing. I think there's a lot of pressure. It's almost like, oh, you don't own your property, you're renting. And it's almost become a bit of a taboo. And that's what I really hate, because, and I can tell you, I think, you know, I do own a property, but I also know by owning a property, I don't have the flexibility to up and move and go where I want when I want. You lose that flexibility. So, you know, there's
so many pros and cons, right? There's always pros and cons. And I like the twist that you put on it. For once, it's like, maybe this news is bad news, maybe it's good news. But ultimately, It's just data. And it's what you're reading in data, this idea that people aren't putting off life decisions just because they haven't got into a property yet. I mean, I feel like you mentioned, if you go back 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago, it was this concept that get the house first, and then you get the kids, and you can get the dogs, and you can get, you know, all this kind of stuff. Whereas nowadays, it's like, you know, just get, have the life you want to live and have the property at the right time. Don't necessarily rush it. And that's maybe what we're seeing. I know you mentioned, again, this taboo about the idea of renting. You know, that saying, renting is throwing money down the drain, or you're paying somebody else's mortgage.
No, it's not.
It's just not. I feel like we're getting wiser onto what renting is. It's a really reasonable and sometimes financially savvy decision for young people to make. I know you mentioned, again, that Zoopla study about 8% cheaper to buy than it is to rent. But I suppose they're looking at long-term kind of comparisons. If you're looking for, like, 1 year here, 1 year there, you don't know where you want to live, you want to try here, you want to try there, you want to try moving out, but you're going to go back to mum and dad a year later, then obviously renting makes sense because it's a time cost thing. A property makes sense if you're going to stay in it for a very long period of time. We're talking 5-10 years minimum. And I like it. So young people are making more decisions. And one other thing that I really like that you said was this idea of moving back with mum and dad. It used to be like embarrassing, but I feel like now we're shifting the point where more people are staying with mum and dad for longer than aren't.
Yes.
And if you've got that option, like, bloody take it, right?
Exactly. Honestly, it's a brilliant decision. And I actually think the fact that people are putting it off till later in stage, and you know, you made a really good point there about the fact that buying is something you do and you're settling and you don't intend to move. You know, if I want to take a job elsewhere, I would have to think about selling my house and thinking, well, actually, can I just up and move? It's not easy. And I think that's a critical thing. I think understand what you want from life. Mm-hmm. So actually, it is a data point, but it's not a bad thing necessarily. I think you need to see it as your own situation. I think this is the right thing for me. If renting's right for you, it's right for you. If buying's right for you, it'll be right for you when it's right for you. But I think what we do need to move away is essentially from this pressure that we feel to buy. And why are you buying? Is it for the right reasons, or because it's just because society tells you to buy it and because that is the expectation?
Yeah, I always tell people, they're like, when do you know when to buy? Like, should you just be buying as soon as possible? The truth is, number one, you should buy when you've run the numbers and financially it makes sense. But number two, like you mentioned, the other non-financial reasons why to buy, because you want to be in that place for a very long period of time. You want to feel settled. You want to have that ability to do what you want with your property. Those are just as important reasons. And if those aren't the things that you're looking for in life, like let's say you maybe want to live somewhere for 5 years, but there's an optionality that you might want to move after two or change countries, then buying is completely not the right answer for you.
Whatsoever. Right?
And I also think that people, young people, especially in their 20s, should hopefully be hearing this news that the average first-time buyer is 36. And realize to themselves, not like, oh shit, like it's going to take ages for me to ever buy a property. But instead think like, I don't have to rush this thing called life right now. Like if the average age is 36 and you're 29 and you haven't bought a property yet, like breathe, relax.
Okay,
like
exactly.
You're young, right? You are still 7 years behind the average age. You have time to put together that deposit.
It's not a race, but it's got to be something that's right for, because it's a huge financial commitment to buy a house. And it's like you say, run the numbers, know what you want from life, know your life goals, but also, you know, if this is something that you do want to, then work out how you might save for that deposit. And going back to mum and dad isn't necessarily a bad thing. I don't want to do it personally, but
But if it's an option and you don't mind living with mum and dad and you don't mind having a full fridge every single week.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what I mean? I mean, I moved out of home when I was 23, I want to say, for a year or two. And my parents were like, why? Like, they genuinely like, just stay, like, you've got like, why does it make sense?
Yeah.
And you know what? In hindsight, maybe it was the right decision. Maybe it was the wrong decision. I probably could have stayed for a little bit longer. And being a bit older now, I understand more their point of view. When you're young and in your 20s, you're like, I just want to move out. Like, I don't care about the money. I just want to, like, be out of home. But as you get older, you start to realize all of those benefits that you are giving up.
And yes,
it's not just rent that you have to pay when you move out. There are a lot of other costs that you probably don't realize your parents or your family are swallowing if you live in that kind of family environment. Things like, you know, the bills. Things like the cost of food. Things like, you know, hosting your friends and all that kind of stuff, when you can just go to the I mean, again, I'm speaking very generally. There are people that aren't in the situation, but going to like the cupboard and pulling out a packet of crisps to share with your friends, rather than to having to like dip into your cupboard that you've got in your house sharing cupboard, you know, you got to go into your section of your food and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
And you got to replenish that yourself with your own money.
Exactly.
There's a lot of hidden costs with moving out that I think people don't take into account.
100%.
So let's discuss another story, because obviously housing is fun and I feel like we've added some good energy and hopefully allow people to kind of relax a little bit into this show.
Exactly.
The next, well, again, you can take it as good news or bad news, is that we've got regular wages growing by 6% annually in February to April this year. Wage growth, generally good thing, right?
Good thing for workers, but I think this also, you know, if you look at it wider picture, it can fuel inflation. I think we've seen signs of the sort of, you know, the job market cooling down, and wage growth has gone up, but we've also seen unemployment rise slightly as well, a small amount. But so I think there is a little bit of a pressure. So the big thing is, will the Bank of England therefore reduce interest rates and reduce the cost of borrowing? Now, I don't think that's going to happen.
I was
going to
say, should we do some prediction time? I mean, the announcement is this week on Thursday. I mean, I know what the odds are saying right now in terms of, by the way, we're talking about the latest interest rate announcements, which is when the Bank of England, come out and announce what they're going to do. Currently we're at 5.25.
That's right.
It's been held there for a long time. I feel like the public are really wanting it to go down because, you know, that allows people to, again, with mortgages and things like that, borrowers in the economy really want it to go down because it makes things cheaper to borrow and hopefully maybe even stimulate the economy. But they've been holding very strong so far and being very firm and saying we are not going down until we are completely ready to do so. So this Thursday, what do we think? I know what
okay.
I think.
So shall I just get out my crystal ball?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think anything's going to change. Now, there's a reason why I don't think anything's going to change is, well, we've got an election coming up. So it seems like a very odd time to actually, and, you know, inflation is still high. It's, you know, it's above its target. So what we need to, you know, I just don't see that happening personally. I think they're just going to sit tight. But maybe in the summer, I think we might start seeing cuts.
I feel like we need to add some spice to this country. Yeah. We've got the election. That's enough spice for this for the next month or two.
I think that we will remain as it is. So I don't know what your crystal ball's saying, but my one's saying nothing's changing.
Well, the other data coming out was that we had zero growth this month.
Exactly.
And no growth means that they're probably not too incentivized, well, to start making drastic changes until they see the economy getting back to its usual, you know, at least a little bit of growth. I'm talking at least 0.1%. 0% is awful.
There's been no growth. So there's been a flat line. And also, last year we were talking about recession. So I feel like the economy's almost playing like catch up at the most. But what we need to see is obviously growth. I think households need to start feeling a little bit confident about their finances. I think there was something I read last week as well, like, you know, everyone's still worried about inflation. Inflation is another figure that's coming out this week as well, so that would be quite interesting. So we've got inflation followed by interest rates followed by election, so it's going to be quite interesting,
followed by the Euro final.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. What an exciting month. And I don't think anything's going to change. I feel like the households are still going to feel a lot of pressure. And I mean, I don't know what inflation will say, but last time the inflation figures come out, it was very much down to energy prices coming down. But that's a very sort of, it's a market that keeps going up and down, so we don't quite know what's going to happen. But yeah, so it's a difficult time at the moment. And I feel even though, even if inflation comes down, I think households are still feeling pressure. And there was a survey out last week and it did say just that households are still worried about inflation. And so even if it does come down, I feel like that pressure on households is not...
You don't feel it, right?
Exactly.
A lower inflation rate, it's really always important to stress that lower inflation doesn't mean that prices aren't still going up and that
slowing.
The previous prices that went up like crazy have been locked in. So we're locking those in, and then the rate that they're growing further is just not that crazy 10% rate we were seeing, you know, 2 years ago at this point anymore.
It's a slowdown,
It's a slowdown ultimately, which is why you said the studies are still showing that families are still struggling. because, you know, prices aren't dropping by any means.
I don't know about you, but I'm still shocked at prices when I go into shops. Like, what? Why am I paying this much for?
Genuinely, when I like normal groceries, right? Yes. At the end of every single month, when I like check out, I mean, I'm a Sainsbury's person. I don't know if that's a shout out that I meant to give on this show, but I'll just say it. I don't even know why I'm a Sainsbury's person. It's just like force of habit. Like, they're the first ones that I end up. They probably gave me a voucher and then I just locked into their portal or something like that. But I just feel like every single week I'm spending crazy amounts of money just to like feed two people in my house.
Yes, exactly. It's ridiculous. I have four, so
double the amount than I'm probably spending.
It's shocking. But what I would say, like, you know, with the interest rates, if we switch it around, I just want to take the savers angle. If people are saving and lucky enough to actually save money, so we mustn't, it's not necessarily all about the borrowing, but if people are saving, this is a really good time to actually lock in some really good yields, because I always talk to people and they always say to me, I've still got to save. I've got this in my current account.
And when's the right time to lock it in?
Now.
Yeah.
Now.
Exactly.
Because those rates will start dropping. So I think even though, you know, we've seen wage growth, I think, yes, that's good, but it can fuel inflation. Economy hasn't grown. I think there is, as you say, there isn't much incentive for the Bank of England to actually start slashing rates at the moment. But I think as a consumer, if you're lucky enough to save, then definitely take advantage of that while you can. We don't have our crystal balls, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
That's telling us what's going to go. But yeah, it'd be interesting to know. It's going to be an exciting week.
It's going to be a great week.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with the election, I think it's going to be quite an important one to keep an eye on.
For sure. Yeah, well, you heard it here first. Savers, it's probably time to start thinking about locking them in. Borrowers, hopefully there's something positive on the horizon. Kalpana, thank you very much
for
coming in, for giving us some incredible insights, and for making people not just listen to me talk for 15 minutes straight. So thank you so much for your time.
You.
Cheers. Anyway, coming up straight after this short break, I have Stephen O'Brien, who is the founder of Steve Teaches Crypto. No hints as to what that conversation is going to be about. We'll catch you then.
That Money Show on FUBAR Radio with Gabriel Nussbaum.
FUBAR Radio presents
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Joining me now is Millie Gooch, author and founder of Sober Girl Sobriety Society. I need to know what is so bad about dating sober.
I think it's just terrifying when it's something that you're not used to, because when I was drinking and dating, you know, like, you use it to calm your nerves, you use it for confidence, you rely on it. And I think that's the one thing I realised when I stopped drinking, is how much I really relied on alcohol. I was always kind of saying, you know, like, oh, I'm not dependent on it, but for my confidence I was really. But I also think there's so many benefits to it. Like, I used to go on so many dates when I was drinking, I'd be like, they are the one, and then I'd meet them like a few weeks later sober and I'd be like, we've got nothing in common, what was going through my mind? I'd be like, oh, it was because I was drunk.
Access all areas with Bobby Norris.
Harpreet, how are you, my love?
I'm great, thank you. How are you? It looks fun in there.
I want to talk about this because obviously you met your partner on The Apprentice. When did you start to get that feeling, I'm into him and this is more than just a banter or a friendship? Because it's a close environment being on a show like that, isn't it?
I really wish I could sit here and give loads of juicy gossip, but actually we used to secretly meet in the laundry room on the show, but we didn't. And when I actually last spoke with yourselves, I think it was right after I'd won, we weren't even flirting, never mind dating. First time that I thought I actually fancied him was when I watched him on TV and I watched episode one.
How fun.
Hang on. You know, he's actually really good looking.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani.
And joining me in the studio, we have Deputy Leader of the Green Party, Zach Polanski. Zach, thank you so much for joining us. How are you keeping, Zach?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. How are you?
So you're hoping for four MPs in the general. You think that's going to happen?
Yeah, that's absolutely the minimum at what we're
I don't want to be Piers Morgan here, but will you take I don't have £1,000, will you take a £100 bet with me that you'll get four MPs?
Well, I do everything in politics to talk about the harms of gambling, so for me to place a bet on there would be pretty horrendous.
Before we had you on, we discussed with the producers as to whether I should do the bet joke, and I said I would because I had every faith that you would answer it in the way I expect a politician of any moral
standing. We should also talk about cryptocurrency, which also is very problematic.
Rishi, if you're listening, mate, that's how you answer a betting question.
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
Hello everyone and welcome back to That Money Show on FUBAR Radio. I promised you that coming up after the break we had Stephen O'Brien, the founder of Steve Teaches Crypto, on to join me so that I can quiz him hard on all things crypto. Anyway, he is here, not live in the studio, but just over there on my screen. How are you doing, Stephen?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Steve or Stephen? Let's start there. It's an important question. Steve.
Yeah, Steve. The only time I hear Stephen is if my mother is very upset with me and she's talking to me very seriously.
Understood.
So Steve is good.
And we can confirm here live in the studio that I'm not your mother. So that one, we got that one out of the way. That was the question that all the audience have been calling in to ask us about. anyway, so a little study here. As of February 2022, I've got it written down that 10% of UK adults were estimated to hold or have held some form of crypto asset. So 10%, I know it's a little amount, but that seems more mainstream than it's ever been before. So what really does that mean? How does cryptocurrency work? I know it's a very, very vague question, but I suppose from the highest level possible. And how is it different to, I suppose, the idea of the other common type of investing, which is in stocks and equities?
Yeah, good question. In very simple terms, cryptocurrency is essentially, they're digital virtual currencies that work on a blockchain, which use cryptography to basically secure the networks. So in very simple terms, basically they are a type of currency or tokens that run on computers decentralized all over the world on different machines, which essentially means it can never be turned off, it can never be stopped, as there's no one single point of failure. And that's like the most simplified version I can kind of give you without going down too many rabbit holes.
Yeah, that's completely fair enough. I can see how we might end up getting on a very focused conversation about a specific area of the blockchain. And everyone might be just sitting there thinking, huh? So we'll try not to confuse people. What about yourself specifically? So cryptocurrency, how long have you been, let's say, into it in the first place? And how did that even happen?
Yeah, so I started my journey of crypto back in 2018. When I've worked in tech for 13 years, so I worked at LinkedIn for 10 years and Google for a few years before that. And I kind of fell into it because I was on the engineering side of things at LinkedIn. So all of my friends and engineer friends ended up buying it randomly one day. And so I kind of jumped into it, didn't have a clue what we were buying, didn't have a clue what we were doing, and we got into XRP at the start, watched it run up 400% and then smash back down for the best part of 2.5 years. So I kind of lost a little bit of interest after that happened, but got really hardcore back into it in 2020, 2021. And I've been in it pretty much full time ever since then.
I was going to say, how's your heart rate? Like, is it strong? People often say that once you get into cryptocurrency, you've got to be in it for the ride. And obviously by that, what we're describing is the volatility. It's a much more volatile investment type than pretty much any other type that the average person might be invested into. But I suppose one that you guys are still kind of looking at the long run for. So it's not something here for today, unless you're a day trader, that obviously that's different, but that you can do with any asset. Any asset varies on a day-to-day basis. Cryptocurrency for the long-term investor is a more difficult one for people to understand, like we said, because of these variations. So let's say I am someone that like is quite risk averse, like I need, you know, I don't like risk, but you are trying to teach me the benefits of crypto within my world. How would you go about explaining it and making me come to terms with this idea of this little roller coaster ride I might be going on?
Yeah, for sure. I guess the biggest difference and the biggest and most simplest way I can kind of maybe on board someone like my mother and my father, I guess, in that sense, is just to look at specifically Bitcoin or Ethereum as just exposure to something that's outside of the traditional financial system, that's outside of the, you know, the more regulated sort of industries, and something that's just completely different. So you're kind of, I kind of view, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum, specifically Bitcoin, as your store of value, but really as a hedge against banks, a hedge against governments, a hedge against the stock market, just something a little bit different that you can actually invest in. And I suppose you asked earlier, like, what are those differences? And I suppose a few components, really, you touched on one of them, is the volatility. So cryptocurrency is very, very volatile, which means the price goes up and down like a hormonal teenager, I guess you could say. It's decentralized as well, which, you know, very different to traditional investments like stocks, like bonds, for example. And it simply means that it's not controlled by one central authority like government or financial institution, which then leads on to the accessibility of it. Because of that, it's traded 24/7. So you have access to trade the markets. If you're a trader or a long-term investor, you have that access, you know, 24/7, your weekends aren't closed or anything like that. And then the knock-on effect of that as well is this, because of the fact that it's not centralized, The regulation is quite loose on certain areas of crypto, which has pros and cons, I guess, depending on which way you look at it. Obviously, as you're going down to some of the smaller cryptocurrencies, there is a lot of manipulation, etc., in the market. So that is definitely one thing to take into account.
Yeah.
Biggest difference really is, unlike a stock necessarily or a treasury bond, let's say, you can actually own the assets. So I think that was my biggest kind of draw towards it, towards cryptocurrency, specifically Bitcoin. But any of the assets, really, you can actually take ownership of those digital assets. You can store them in what looks like a little USB key, but is actually a cryptography device, which is a hardware wallet. And so you can have them on your person. You can travel across, you know, technically across borders if that's something you wanted to do. But you actually own the asset. You can lock that wallet in a safe, forget about it for 5-10 years, like you would maybe a few pieces of gold or a gold bar or something like that. And yeah, they're the main kind of real key differences and benefits I see of holding crypto, as opposed to, I do also hold stocks as well, you know, inside of Fidelity and some other brokers, but I just like the self-custody aspect of crypto and Bitcoin itself as well.
Ah, brilliant. I mean, I think that one of the key words that you said there, what you're describing, was this idea of diversification, you know, having exposure to more than just, you know, a specific category of investment. So it's not just stocks, it's not just property, can't think of another one off the top of my head right now, but it's not just even just crypto. It's this idea of spreading your bets. And often when people do ask me, like, listen, I'm this kind of financial guy that's meant to be teaching people, you know, safe practices with finance, and they're like, oh, but I really want to get into like crypto, I really like think it's a thing. I always tell people, like, I'm not going to tell you not to. It's a form of diversification. Just make sure that you've got it distributed to the quantity of your portfolio that you feel safe with. So let's say you're like, again, you can't really handle the risk, but you're quite interested in it. So make it 1% of your portfolio, make it 2% of your portfolio, make it 5% of your portfolio. As long as you've got that diversification, and if one thing goes wrong, you've got the other side to back you up. I'm not against that at all, if that's something that interests you. And I think that's really important to say. One thing I do want to ask you about, which I'm sure you get a lot of news and attention around, is this negative side of crypto. You mentioned it briefly before about some of the bad players, especially when it comes to smaller coins. Why do you think there are so many of them within this kind of realm, trying to take advantage of people and, I suppose, give the entire crypto market a bad name?
Why? That's a good question. I think people like to make money. And I suppose that one of the benefits, which also could be viewed as a con, I suppose, on the regulation side, is because of the fact that it's decentralized, and that for the most part, when you set up a crypto wallet, there's no KYC necessarily. It's a string of numbers and letters. It's very, very, very difficult to pin, like a smart contract, which is would be if a cryptocurrency was launched, you'd be able to, you know, use the contract address to actually find that crypto. It's very difficult to pin that to an actual person if that project, for example, is just created and doesn't go through an exchange which would have KYC. It's very difficult to track that. So because of that, it's very easy to have a lot of pump and dump schemes, Ponzi schemes, etc., that essentially are, you know, like a developer would release a crypto or a smart contract and pump it up and then essentially pull or rug all the money and run away with it. It's very difficult to track that person down, nearly impossible in most cases. And so humans are humans, and if just a quick way to make money, like most, unfortunately, a lot of people in the world will take that route.
Well,
and
I was gonna say,
that's as simple as that, really.
For that reason, I mean, I feel like it speaks against the whole the ethics of crypto. But do you think that there's more regulation required within the industry, even though it's the whole idea is it's meant to be anti-regulation? Because there still needs to be some safeguarding, because there are vulnerable people out there. I mean, what was this one study that I've got here? Is that the NHS says it's currently treating a rising number of compulsive crypto traders. That's the NHS that are now talking about it themselves. And obviously, we're talking about bad players. This is another mental health side of it. So does regulation need to come in? And if so, how to, I suppose, appease the people that don't want regulation?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, there is definitely regulation coming in. I mean, every cryptocurrency exchange you see in the UK and Ireland are regulated by central banks, both in the UK and Ireland, as well as the European Central Bank. So, and then you have your new spot ETFs that have been launched as well by all these major players. So I guess, like, there is regulation coming in, and depending on your risk tolerance, you can expose yourself to a certain element of risk or no risk, I suppose, in terms of if you want to look at maybe a BlackRock or like a spot ETF as maybe less risk because it's, you know, regulated. So I would say, like, you know, it's we do have those options of regulated kind of onboarding into crypto, and, you know, certain aspects I think should be a little bit the wild, wild west, you know, like, if you want to take a gamble on something and maybe you can get a 1,000% return or a 2,000% return and maybe increase the quality of your life, like who's to say that, you know, you should not do that? It's like a lot of people spend money in other areas like alcohol, like cigarettes and other things that maybe, you know, are not as productive and have no potential of any good ROI, maybe you could argue. So the regulation needs to be there for people that need it, I guess, and certain areas of the industry, especially if we're to be taken seriously, you know, and crypto is to be taken seriously, which it has been, in, I guess, in the last, you know, 5 months with the approval of some key spot ETFs.
Yeah.
But I think there'll always be an element of things that just won't be regulated because the industry is so vast now, it's so wide. The internet is, you know, you can't turn the internet off, which really means you can't stop people from deploying smart contracts. So it's a difficult one to really enforce.
But I suppose if you're not going to force it with regulation, the second best option is doing what you're doing, right? Education. And education can hopefully stop the bad things that regulation would, I suppose, force people to stop. But also, that would result in some of the positive side also being rubbed out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think the key to the crypto space really is education, because even on my Instagram page, you know, obviously I get a lot of clone Instagram page copies that try and DM people pretending that they're me. And so even just education on social media as a whole, as well as blockchain and crypto, is really important, because it's not just crypto now. We're starting to see all these scams. You see banking, people getting scammed off their own banks, providing, you know, personal information.
Yeah.
I think education across every area of your life is going to benefit you, whether it's like getting better at your career, whether it's, you know, understanding how social media works properly or scams work, and then leading into blockchain, crypto, if that's something you want to go down that road and actually, you know, get educated and start buying and investing in cryptocurrency.
Amen to all of that. I want to ask you two final quick questions. Number one is, you have to share your biggest win and your biggest loss within the crypto world since you joined.
Oh God, the biggest losses, they're pretty easy. I've had multiple smaller cap cryptocurrencies go to zero. Mm-hmm. And that is the risk you jump into. Certain meme coins, you know, which are basically just kind of community tokens, don't really have any real massive intrinsic value, but more of a community led value.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I've had multiple of those go to zero. Biggest win, I suppose, would probably be 2,000% maybe ROI. I'm not at that level of getting 100 to 200x's just yet, unfortunately, but I'm only in the space, you know, three years. The people that are in the space getting those kind of ROI, they've been around for a long time, or maybe I'm in the wrong networks, I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, 20x, that's nothing to turn your nose up at, and we've had a few of those. So
not at all. And then the last one is just one piece of advice, one sentence that you can give to people when it comes to investing in cryptocurrency.
Yeah, this is very simple. So I would say learn first, start small, diversify, and make sure you're following the right people, because trust me, once the crypto bull market really starts to take off, you're going to see a lot of influencers coming out of the woodwork that have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. Follow the pages that have been around for the last 2.5-3 years when there was nothing happening in crypto and everyone thought it was a scam and nobody wanted to know anything about it. These are the people to follow, and these are the people to trust and get your education from.
Voila. I think that's a brilliant note to end it on. Thank you very much for your time. And I suppose you can follow Steve Teaches Money on social for anyone.
Steve Teaches Crypto.
Steve Teaches Crypto. Steve, that's why we got you on the show, to correct me for things like that. Steve Teaches Crypto makes sense completely based on the past 15 minutes of conversation for anything else. So thank you again for your time.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Brilliant. Steve Teaches Money, Steve Teaches Crypto. I mean, only I can make that kind of mistake. Anyway, it's now time quickly for Money Tip of the Week. I love this segment. I just give you one short snippet that you can actually practically go and take into your life to make you better with money. And this week is something that I've been experimenting with recently. So if you are in a couple, particularly probably if you're married, you have a shared pot of money, right? A lot of people just have one bank account and everyone's paycheck just goes into that and you spend out of that. And that's how life goes on. Now, this is something that me and my missus have tried recently, which is really fun. So when you do that, I suppose you lose some of your independence with money, this idea that everything you have is yours. It's not anymore. It's shared. It's one entity. And we were trying to figure out the best way to kind of, you know, still get that independence, still be able to go out and spend money on whatever we want, you know, without ever feeling guilty. In a way, because ultimately you do need to have some of your money to spend on literally whatever you want without having to think, oh, I could have put that to save towards, you know, a joint project that you and your partner have. So what we're trying out is literally 10% of our money every single month gets split between us. So we group the entire salary, 10% split, cut in half. We each get that, goes into a separate account, and that is just free money to spend. I call it the 10% split money partner hack, trick, scheme, thing, budgeting. Haven't quite mastered the name just yet. But if you are in a couple and you're trying to figure out the right way to budget, give this one a go. I mean, we've only been doing it for less than a month already, and it's just really nice. You know, you've got that little pot of money that is just yours. You can spend it on just ice cream, if that's all you want to spend on, whatever it is. And it's a nice way to kind of have control of your finances, not feel guilty, but still be responsible with your budget. Anyway, that's it for now. And joining me after this short break is Claire Seal, a content creator and author. I'll catch you then.
Making personal finance simpler with Gabriel Nussbaum. This is That Money Show.
Hey!
FUBAR Radio presents
Access All Areas.
Mark from Married at First Sight UK.
See, at the wedding, you told Sean you were 26, but you're actually 36.
Oh, yeah.
So drop in that decade. We ain't gone 1 or 2 years either side. What was going through your head when you put that? I'm gonna shave off 10 years.
A 26. Third of your life.
Yeah.
It was instant reaction. As soon as anyone says to me, how old are you? I'm like 26. I just stopped counting after 26. Would I have told him? Probably not.
No. Yeah. Ever?
Well, maybe when we're 80 years old and we've got the grandkids running around. And
except
like,
you wouldn't be 80 years old. You'd be 98.
I'd be 26 still. I'd be going around the corner for some more injections.
Politics Uncensored. Joining me now, the former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, MP. And there you are stood with hundreds of thousands of people at Glastonbury singing, "Oh, Jeremy Corbyn." What is that like?
It was quite extraordinary. It was an amazing experience, and I was very pleased we did it. The office got very excited about Glastonbury. Every single person in the office thought it was necessary for them to be at Glastonbury with me.
Yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Every single one said it was really necessary for me to come.
The Dating Show.
I'm friends with a fair few exes, and I think you can be friends with an ex, but I genuinely do. But I do think that it's timing is everything with that.
I think it depends what you cast as a friend.
Yeah,
are you talking about someone you're going to hang out with on your sofa? Like, if you've already shagged, isn't that a bit weird?
I think that's a different level of friend. I think that's a different level of friend. You can be friends with someone, but you can't be like best fucking friends with someone. I mean, I've got exes that I talk to about their current partners and whatever else, and they'll tell me about that sort of stuff. But I wouldn't say, oh, do you want to come over for fucking Chinese and chill on the sofa?
You're listening to FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to That Money Show. I am That Money Guy. Makes sense. That Money Show, That Money Guy. But joining me now, I have Claire Seal, who is a content creator and author. You might know her from the page My Frugal Year, which she started back in 2019. Anyway, Claire, welcome to the show. How are you doing? Oh, I think I might have you on mute. That might be my mistake. That might be yours, but it's all good. Whilst we just try and sort Claire out, I will try and answer some of your questions, and she'll jump on in a second. So your questions are right now. We're just going to get Claire online. Don't worry about it, peoples. How do you save money easy? That is a brilliant question. You save money easy by taking it out of your paycheck first. That is one of the most important things. So you take money out of your paycheck when you get paid, and then you spend the rest. Not spend and then save at the end of it. Anyway, I think we have Claire on the line now. Claire, how are you doing? Can you hear me loud and clear?
I can hear you. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you loud and clear. Listen, this is part of the fun of being live. It's fine. It happens. Anyway, how are you doing? And welcome to That Money Show.
Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, I'm really well.
Absolute pleasure. I'm excited to learn more about your journey. In particular, I believe My Frugal Year, if I have my facts correct, it started back in 2019. Now, what happened in 2019 that made you start a page called My Frugal Year?
I just reached a complete breaking point in my relationship with money. I think I was 29. I had been sort of working and earning for the best part of a decade. And I had had my first son quite young by today's standards. I was 25. My husband was 24. I had got married and had a second baby. And it was sort of when I, towards the end of that second maternity leave, that everything just seemed to fall apart. We had been accruing sort of small amounts of debt for years, just trying to keep up with like the cost of living. And it was nowhere near what it is now as well back then. And we'd accrued equivalent to my annual salary in credit card overdraft debt by the time I was 29. So I just remember having a phone call with my bank where they asked when I was going to be able to sort of come back within my overdraft limit. And I was like, oh, it's going to be the end of the month. This was, I think, the 14th of March. And the woman on the other end of the phone asked why. And I don't think I'd ever really asked myself that question. I just heard myself say, there's just no money left. And I think, you know, she was really then helpful. She refunded some charges, which brought me back within my limit. And I came off that phone call, like knowing things had to change, but also maybe feeling like I could change things. And I'd felt so powerless for such a long time. I'd just been going along with the ride. So I did what any sane person would do. And I set up an anonymous Instagram account to sort of share all. And I used it as a diary. It was anonymous for a year. And then I sort of, I had to because I published a book, but I came out and said, you know, this is me. And this has been my experience. But I was just met by loads of people who'd been terrified to talk about the mistakes that they'd made with money because, you know, we live in an age where frugality is really fetishized, but no one really wants to talk about the nitty gritty of what it means to have financial difficulty. Everyone's very uncomfortable talking about financial difficulty if you have privilege. So if you're earning well, but still struggling to keep up with your living costs, there's quite a big taboo on that. It's been a really interesting 5 years. And, you know, we paid off the debt. We managed to buy a house. But Instagram won't let me change my handle.
Amazing. So it's stuck. Well, I think it's a great name. I mean, it stems to your roots, right? And how everything started. And I know you made a joke of it, but it's amazing that you were even anonymously confident sharing that. Because even I don't think that I would have that level of confidence to share, you know, all of the pitfalls, all of the struggles you're going through. And I suppose you probably don't even realize, you probably get a lot of messages, the amount of difference you've made to people that have seen that and realize, oh, I'm not the only one that does it like this. I'm not the only one that's struggling. And there is a way out of it. So, I mean, probably to say thank you, kind of, it's like thank you for your service kind of thing, because it's so important. These conversations aren't had. People don't open up and share their difficulties with money. What was one stat I saw recently? 1 in 3 people earning over 6 figures live paycheck to paycheck. I mean, you were speaking about the high earners not wanting to talk about their difficulties keeping up with their living expenses. There it is for you right there. Imagine earning 6 figures and not being able to keep hold of that paycheck at the end of a month. So it's far more common than people think, but far less common for people to talk about, like you do.
Yeah, I think there's a certain amount of sort of like sticking your neck out and sort of accepting that people, you know, I think there's loads of shame when it comes to money and financial difficulty. But I honestly think that that shame is really a symptom of the judgment that exists in society. I don't think that people are feeling ashamed for the sake of it. I think they're feeling ashamed because you can't really sort of open your phone or open a newspaper without seeing these huge judgments piled on people who've made mistakes with money. And I think it's acceptable for people to slag you off about being bad with money in a way that it might not be for like other mistakes that you might make or other, you know, sort of compulsive behaviors. For example, compulsive shopping is a massive problem, but it's sort of, yeah, I don't know. It's still in this zone where I think it's acceptable to heap judgment. I mean, literally today I've had an article be published talking about monthly costs of raising a family and just so many comments judging because I've shared openly what I spend month to month raising my family.
It's
just
crazy. Nitpicking on like the little subcategories that mean a lot to you, but to them mean nothing. So they're like, how can you spend that? Honestly, anytime I share anything within my budget, that like, for example, I was speaking last week to someone and they were like, I was in debt, but I still wanted to pay for a cleaner. And the reason I did that was because, you know, I wanted to have time with my children and like to spend hours cleaning the house. I think that the amount I was spending on that was worth the time that I got back with my family. And she was saying the amount of judgment and hate she got. They were like, you're in debt and you're paying for a cleaner. Like, how stupid can you be? And she was like, how can you say that? Like, it's a completely personal judgment. And that, I feel like that's what you're sharing about when you are open with your money. There's always going to be someone out there that wants you to do it differently because that's how they do it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, what I want my community to be, and it has grown into a community. You know, I see so many people giving each other, you know, lifting each other up in the comments, you know, definitely outweighs the number of people who are hopping on there to tear me down. So it's fine. The balance is right at the moment. But, you know, I want it to be a community where people talk about and can learn how to like live the best life that they can with the money that they've got. Because we're, you know, I'm one person. It's not within my, you know, capabilities to make sure that there's economic justice and fairness across the world. Unfortunately, I'm really sorry to break it to everybody. But, you know, what I can do is provide a platform where maybe if I share something openly and back myself and don't sort of hide away in embarrassment or shame, that somebody else feels able to say, oh, actually, I'm in that situation. I'm struggling with that as well. And sort of bridge that gap between the people who need some help and advice and the help and advice that's available, because I think that's a massive problem when it comes to money.
I can agree more. All right, Claire, we now would like some of the tips, the things that you did. I mean, you told us earlier that it was about an annual salary worth of debt that you were in back in 2019. You've clearly gotten yourself into a much better position today. So if you are someone that has that level of debt, maybe worse, maybe better, but still feeling that, like you mentioned, that anxiety, that shame about it, what's the first thing you can do to turn things around? And then maybe what are some other ideas that you can start considering to help you get from a position of, you know, debt to a position of control?
Yes, I mean, I think the first thing to do is to really be honest with yourself about whether the situation that you're in is manageable or not. Because if it isn't, if you're really struggling to keep up with repayments, then getting in touch with a debt charity like Step Change or Christians Against Poverty is the best thing that you can do. And they are so brilliant. They're a bit like a GP, like you're horribly embarrassed, but they hear this stuff all the time. And totally judgment-free, and they just can help you to make a plan. And everyone who I've spoken to who's gone through Step Change has said that, you know, the moment that they came off the phone, they just felt this huge weight shift off their shoulders. So there's that. But also what we did and what quite a lot of people want to do is they say, you know, sort of, I'm in this mess. It feels manageable for me to get out of it. It might take a long time, but I want to do this. So what you can do is especially if you've got multiple lenders, is you can phone your lenders and see if there's anything they're willing to do for you as a gesture of goodwill. So they might freeze interest for a while. That can really help you to bounce things back in the right direction. They might refund charges that have been applied to your account sort of maybe unfairly if you're in financial difficulty. So if you do that across all of the different places that you've got borrowing, then you can get a really nice sort of shunt back in the right direction. The second thing, and, you know, I'll say it until I'm blue in the face, is you've got to have a really realistic look at your budget. There isn't a magic bullet that's going to conjure up like an extra 500 quid a month. So have a realistic look at your budget, download all of your transactions, get your highlighters out, you know, color code everything. The first thing is to see where you can cut without losing value. Think about the money that you waste first, cut the waste first, but also try and ring fence some things that you do enjoy. And this is, I think, made the biggest difference to me, was that we did ring fence a couple of, you know, a little bit of money each month for enjoyment. And that is what stopped it from being like this sort of yo-yo diet budgeting that I see quite a lot of people do, where, you know, you really deprive yourself and then you fall off the wagon and you end up sort of back where you started. Mm-hmm. You've undermined your confidence that this is something you can do. It's definitely not the one, that kind of really extreme budgeting. But do be honest with yourself, be thorough when you're doing it. Make sure you're claiming what you're eligible for as well, especially if you're, you know, if you're a carer, a parent, if you're earning a low income. There's a brilliant organization called Income Max, run by a guy called Lee Healy, who's awesome. I've seen him speak a couple of times. And their whole purpose is, you know, to help to sort of, you know, bridge that. There's 85 billion, I think, in benefits that go unclaimed each year. So to help people to claim what they're eligible for. And it might be that, you know, you've missed something and you don't need to struggle as much as you are struggling. And then it's just take it month by month and remember that the time's going to pass anyway. That's what I've repeated to myself so many times when it felt like the biggest slog. And it did take us 2 years to pay it all off. But I did sort of just repeat to myself that the time was going to pass anyway. And it did, you know, and I was 29 then, I'm nearly 35 now, and I'm still young, surprise. So, you know, I think that there's a lot to be said for trying to be patient, and I'm not a very patient person, but just those small gains are what makes a massive difference overall.
That is, I mean, like, if we could just cut off a segment of the show right now and just send it to the entire country, that would be it. Because there was so much practical advice in there, not just mathematical, which was great as well. You know, the literal calling up someone and freezing interest rates or cutting and getting, you know, chargebacks on things that maybe you didn't need to spend in the first place, or the highlighter and getting rid of waste. But it was also the psychological aspect, the idea of being kind to yourself. You know, still, you can still spend money whilst you're on this journey, as long as it's in a deficit. As long as you're in a deficit, like, you're on the right track, right? And it's just making sure you're in the right direction. If your debt is shrinking, even if it's by, let's say, £1 a month, obviously you want the more the better, but you're going in the right direction. And then it's just time, right? Because ultimately it's deficit plus time equals getting yourself out of that position in the first place, which is really, absolutely, really great to hear.
Sorry, to add to that, that if you're making all of the minimum repayments and you're just about managing, but you can't afford to pay any more, a really good tip is to just, instead of setting it to the minimum, set it to the amount that you're currently paying as the minimum, because as your minimum decreases, you'll still carry on paying the same amount that's affordable. And again, you'll be getting that deficit without, like, spending more. It's a really, really good thing to do.
I've never thought of that one before, but yeah, brilliant. If you just keep the absolute amount you're spending right now per month to pay it off, just do that continuously, right? That's basically what you're saying. Don't let it, like, decrease as your balance decreases. I love that. So, I mean, what is your relationship like now with money? Because you've clearly got it. You said it took 2 years, but you got yourself out of the debt. You're now a homeowner, so you're clearly in a strong position. So what is that like, obviously the relationship at the beginning, not great, but today, how does it look?
I mean, it's much better than it was. I think that, you know, like anyone with anything, there are days where I feel like it needs work and there are days when I feel really on top of it. And that's sort of just the way, I think it's one of those things where it's going to be a lifelong thing to manage that. I think money is a bit, again, it's a bit like food in that quite a lot of us have a bit of a tense relationship with it, but you can't live completely without it. You can't go cold turkey on money. So I think the main difference is that now I really sort of see the money as a tool to build the life that I want for myself and my family, rather than seeing the money as like the object in itself. I'm definitely not scared of it anymore. So I think, like a lot of people who maybe have some money issues from growing up, I almost was allergic to having money in my bank account. Like it had to go. I was working to like zero all the time. But I kind of started to preempt that by making sure that I was paying myself first and money was going into first to debt and then into savings, so it wasn't in my like current account. But now I find it bearable to have money in there and not think, oh, like what does that need to be spent on now immediately?
I love that. Well, Claire, thank you so much for jumping on today. Honestly, I feel like the person, anyone listening to this, is going to hear something relatable, but also practical advice to get them from a negative place to a positive place. And that's the difference we're trying to make on this show. So all I say is thank you and well done on your journey, and keep sharing the message because it's clearly making the world of good to a lot of people.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
No worries at all. So there you go. That was Claire from My Frugal Year. Go check her out on social media. Clearly a brilliant presence within the financial education space. And as always, at this point of the show, we like to share scam of the week. Not where we scam you, where we warn you of a scam. Important to always say. This one's actually going to be a bit of a personal one. So I'm on social media. I educate people about money. And Steve from Steve Teaches Crypto said the same thing. There are so many people that like to make fake profiles of these people on social media to try and represent who they are. And then they try and, especially if, like, say, I'm a financial educator, they're going to message you about money and try and get that off of you. My advice to you watching this right now is I will never, and most social media people will never, ask you for your personal details for your money. If there's a specific reason, you'll know why they're messaging you in the first place. But otherwise, please ignore. Please double check that the person that's messaging you, if they're meant to be a legit person on social media, is actually who they say they are. Not all of us have these random hundreds of second accounts. Barely any of us do. So this is my message to you. If you get messaged on social media about money, if it involves personal details, think scam first. And if it's not, then you'll work that out later. But that's just my tip for today. Anyway, I always like to answer a few questions. And we are live, so if anyone does have questions that is watching this live right now, please feel free to stick them in there right now. I was answering a few earlier. This is the time to get better with money, ask those embarrassing questions, and get them off of your shoulders. So the first question that we've got coming in is from Lewis, who DM'd the show at That Money Show on Instagram, asking, I only have one current account and a credit card. Is it safe to leave all my money in one account, or should I spread it across multiple current accounts? I think you can only have one current account. That's why it's called a current account. You can have, like, other accounts, but one current account. But yeah, I mean, it depends what you're doing with it. I don't like to have a different account for account's sakes. Like, it's not worth just having an account with every single bank. It just makes things messy. I like things to be nice and neat with my money. You should have various accounts for different things. So, like, if you haven't want to invest, you should have an investing account. If you want to save, you should have a short-term savings account. If you want to put money and lock it away, you should have a long-term savings account. If you have an emergency fund, you should have that separate from your current pot of money within your current account, so that you don't spend it by mistake because it's an emergency fund in the first place. So that's the answer to having why you should have multiple accounts. But you shouldn't have, you know, three different saving accounts for saving account's sake. The only time that I would argue with my own advice right there is that most accounts are something called FSCS protected, which means that you are insured up to £85,000 should shit hit the fan and that bank disappears overnight for various reasons that banks have done in the past. £85,000. So let's say you are that lucky person that has £86,000 in cash. I would put £1,000, start putting into a second account if it offers you the same benefits. Obviously, if you're a very, very, very wealthy individual, then you could start to look at different types of accounts that certain banks offer where they do hold large amounts of your money and probably are insured against it. Another question that's coming in live right now is, are you a qualified IFA? I'm not a qualified IFA. I do not give any financial advice. This show isn't financial advice. This show is a conversation around money, and I share some of my opinions. I will never tell you what to do specifically with your money. And one day maybe I will become a qualified IFA. So thank you very much for asking. And it's always good to confirm that with people listening. And I will answer one more question, which came in from Leia, that said, what are your thoughts on cash stuffing diaries? I have seen them everywhere on TikTok, but not sure if it will help me. Cash stuffing diaries. Don't do it myself. It's this idea of, like, you literally take your cash out into physical money and put it into different folders, I believe, dependent on what you're going to do with it. If that is the tactic that will allow you to save more than any other way, brilliant. But ultimately, I don't like cash for cash's sake, because with inflation, physical cash loses value. With money in the bank, with a savings account that has interest rates, your money will increase dependent on that interest rate. So if it's like, I will only save money if I'm doing the cash stuffing method, then yeah, let's save money that way. Stuff it and then put it in the bank, please, where it can actually grow value. Whereas if it's like, I don't mind which method I choose, I would probably keep it digitally. Just for me, that's easier. I'd probably lose any kind of cash stuffing diary that I have. Anyway, that's all we have time for. If you do have any questions, and I didn't manage to answer yours in today's show, which I didn't because I only answered about two or three questions, please DM at That Money Show on Instagram with your questions. We will answer them, or we will try to answer as many as possible every single week during this show. So you can find us, like I said, at That Money Show on Instagram, and you can find this episode on every single podcasting platform, wherever you get your podcast from, at That Money Show again. And as always, you can listen to us live on the FUBAR app every week on Mondays at 4 p.m. Anyway, thank you so much for joining today. I hope you have got a little bit better with money than you were roughly 1 hour ago. Thank you to Claire for joining today. Thank you for Kalpana. I knew I was going to pronounce that wrong as well. And thank you to Steve. Some brilliant guests. I have been That Money Guy. This has been That Money Show. And hopefully you've got a little bit better with your money. Thanks for tuning in.